everybody. My name is Jaquel Crow, and I'm the editor-in-chief of TheRevolution.com and the author of the upcoming book, This Changes Everything: How the Gospel Transforms the Teen Years. Today, I am very excited to be joined by Tony Ranke to talk about how young people can glorify God through technology and social media. Welcome, Tony.
Thanks, Jaquel. I appreciate the opportunity to come and to talk about these very important issues that I've been looking into for the past few years. So thank you for having me.
Yeah, for sure. Now, before we get into things, for the young people or old people out there who are wondering just who you are, could you tell us a little bit about yourself, your work, and your writing?
Yeah, you bet. So I serve as a senior writer on the staff at DesiringGod.org. I do some editing. I also host, I host John Piper's podcast, the Ask Pastor John podcast, and we're closing in on our fourth year now. We're almost done with, and nearly 1,000 episodes where Pastor John just answers exegetical and theological and ethical questions. I've been married to my wife, Carol Lee, for almost 20 years now, and we are both from Nebraska. We spent some time in the DC area, and now we live in Minneapolis. We've been here for about 5 years. And we have three kids. We have a 15-year-old son, an 11-year-old daughter, and a 9-year-old son. And so we're in the thick of parenting, and specifically parenting in the digital age. By trade, I'm a nonprofit journalist and a researcher. My work in ministry has been online for the past 9 years, really trying to master online platforms like Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and blogging, and using them with gospel purpose. And so I think of myself as an investigative journalist, sort of researching the effects of popular media on the Christian life. And so, you know, wanting to be eager to embrace what we can embrace, redeeming what we can redeem, rejecting what needs to be rejected, and then in all of the gray areas, just walking with wisdom in seeking to use technology in a way that glorifies God. So I've written a book on books and reading and literacy and literature, and I've written now a book on smartphones and social media, and there's other areas that I want to address in the future. But that's kind of my beat, if you will, the cross section of where the dominant media technologies of our culture intersect with Christian life.
Yeah, that's good, and that's incredibly important, especially coming from a teenager who is coming of age in this digital age, that these topics are incredibly important, and I have benefited so much from your writing and your research on these topics. You're welcome. So my first question for you, it might be a little bit obvious, but I think it's important, and it's, is technology inherently a bad thing? And if not, how should Christians view technology?
That's good. That's a great question. The place to begin, probably before we even ask, is technology a bad thing or is technology a good thing, is to simply admit that technology is a pervasive thing. So everything that we touch right now is a product of technological innovation. The computers we're using right now, the software we're using, the connection that we have, our microphones, our headphones, the keyboards, lighting, notes, my desk, my chair, like everything around me is a product of technology in some way. And so, you know, there's that old story of the three fish. There's two fish swimming in one direction in a stream. They're younger fish, and there's an older fish swimming in the other direction, and they cross paths. And the older fish says, "Nice water today, isn't it?" And the young fish look at each other and like ask, you know, what is water? You know, it's something like technology for us, and that is that it's so immersive that it's like oxygen. It's so much around us that we don't even recognize technology as what it is. So we're sort of bathed in technology, if you will. And so personally, to answer your question, I take more of an expansive view of technology, probably more expansive than most people would in this field. I intentionally hold technology together from the Garden of Eden to the new creation and all the innovation that happens in between. I'm going to hold all of that together in one sort of developing timeline. And so you've got primitive dirt tools, you know, and agriculture that come out of the Garden of Eden. And then in the New Jerusalem, you see these streets paved with clear gold, some sort of a pavement that's clear enough that glory passes through it. And so I don't think that's human technology, but that's some form of heightened technology that's going to be in the new age. And so there's a continuity I see between those two pillars of human history. And so the bottom line is that I see technology starting in the Garden of Eden with the textile industry. It begins there. There's an angel with a sword. So there's some sort of weaponry that is a precursor to all the other weapons that will be created later. And so there's, for me, I don't see a hard distinction between tools and technology. That makes me a little bit different here. Some people would want to say that the coming of electrical technology marks a distinction between tools in the past and technology in the present. Amish communities might make that distinction. I don't see that as a hard distinction. So if we begin in the Garden of Eden, my understanding of technology is that God created everything out of nothing. And in that action, he stuffs raw materials into the earth, and he mixes those raw materials at a ratio that he deems suitable. And so there's chemicals that we can pull out of the ground, we can refine them, we can mix them with other elements, we can cause explosions. And so the raw materials that we have in creation, they're there because God put them in the ratio that he deemed necessary. We can then create synthetic materials out of that, but the bottom line is he is the one who initiates all that. Then he establishes natural laws to govern our experience of this world. So gravity holds us down right now. Water flows downhill, not uphill. So God governs over this creation through some natural laws that he set in place, and then he puts in place innovators. So you've got Adam and Eve, and they're now commissioned to rule over the earth, to cultivate it, to keep it. And so all of this together, the raw materials, the natural laws, and the innovators, all of this forms something of a railroad track of innovation that's all set in motion by the Creator, and it's all governed over by his sovereign design. So that does not mean that all technology is good. There's evil technology, and it doesn't mean that good technology can't be used for evil purposes. What I'm simply saying is that there's a trajectory of innovation that will unfold as human history unfolds, and it's not going to catch God by surprise. And that's because he sovereignly governs over the entire train track, if you will, of innovation that's inevitable. It's gonna happen. And so back in Adam and Eve's day, you see the beginning of the textile industry, then you see farming is going to come of age, agriculture, the discovery of metals, precious metals that can be traded, and then there's going to be copper and iron, and then human technology is going to create weaponry out of those raw materials. And so you see the rise of military forces, and then comes the innovation of book printing and the Industrial Revolution and lighting and telephones and cars and radios, photography, video, on and on and on, to the point where we have a smartphone in our hands. So smartphone technology is inevitable based upon the tracks that God laid down as a creator and sovereignly superintending all of that. So I hope that makes sense, but that's kind of how I come at technology. So in general and in summary, technology has always been part of the world that God created. It's just been unfolding at different speeds. And now I would say that we are living in an age where we have to adapt so fast because technology is changing faster than probably it ever has before. And so when we're talking about technology and whether it's good or evil, then it really becomes a question of how do we use the technology? And for that, then we really have to get into the details of how we are using the technology ourselves.
Yeah, that makes total sense. And I think that's very important. And like you said, maybe not so common to view technology on that big picture plane that I like how you describe it as a railroad, that technology has always been around. And if we think of it as a tool, just like any other tool that God has given us, that it is something that we wield the power to use for good or evil. So I just got my first smartphone a year ago when I turned 18, and it was kind of like entering a whole new world of access. But you mentioned how smartphones are really at the height of our present technology. But what would you say to a teenager who just got their first smartphone?
That's a really great question. I'm glad you're asking that question. For a teen who just got a smartphone, What I would say to them is really essentially at the core, the same thing I would say to a teen who got their first pistol. I mean, that sounds strong, but let me explain here for a second. Because what you now possess in your hand has tremendous power for good, and it has tremendous power for evil. And so what you choose to do with it makes all the difference in the world, and it will expose sort of your own heart. In other words, a smartphone, it's now like a portal for your influence into the lives of a lot of other people. And it can have a positive effect. It can have a negative effect. The fact is, now that you have this phone, you now have access into the lives of hundreds, thousands, maybe even tens of thousands of people, depending upon how viral things you do is spread online. And so Google expects by 2020 that about 5 billion people will be connected to the internet. 5 billion people. What's interesting about this, and some writers are pointing this out, is that the rise of photography has been like something nobody expected before. So it's estimated that every 2 minutes, Americans take more photographs than were taken in the 19th century. So Americans are taking every 2 minutes more photographs than were taken in the 19th century, the entire century. And so what you're seeing is this sort of global connectedness, but it's a visual, a highly visual medium. So you're starting to see a global community that crosses over language barriers. So someone who only speaks Japanese, who lives in Japan, can take a photo that goes viral that we see in the United States that can't speak Japanese. So there's a universal language starting to take place. That is sort of the macro level, is just a picture of the power of social media. Individually, what it means is that we now have the power to influence the lives of our friends and our family and people across the country that we may not even know in some profound ways. And this is where I think C.S. Lewis really can help us think through what it is that we're doing with our smartphones. So what Lewis says is there's two ways that we influence one another. One, we can edify one another. We can build each other up, or we can tear each other down. You know, we can spread things that are toxic. We can spread things that are edifying. And so it's kind of like a ball on a pool table. You know, you hit the balls, and the balls are going to influence one another. And that's something of what it means to be alive in this world, is we're constantly influencing one another. And so Lewis says we're either building others up or we're tearing other people down. And what this means in his own language is that we're either edifying people so much that we are creating in them, through our influence, someone who is going to be glorified in the presence of God one day. And so if we're building their faith, we are helping to influence someone for their eternal good, someone that will be, if we could see them glorified, we would be tempted to fall on our knees and worship them. But on the other hand, we have this power because we communicate, and because we influence one another, we have this, we also have destructive power. We can tear people down in such a way that we can push people towards unbelief. We can cause people to despair. We can influence people in a negative way, so that what they become ultimately is something more hideous than you could imagine in a horror movie. And so what C.S. Lewis is trying to do through these visuals is help us to see the influence of our words. And so when it comes to the smartphone and the age of social media, we have this tremendous power of influence on those around us. So the power of a smartphone makes a pistol look like a squirt gun in some sense, because we're talking about cyberbullying, of course, which is wicked. That's the power to spark despair in the lives of others, and that's totally evil. But we're also talking about, you know, not texting nudity. We're not sparking lust in other people. All of the seven deadly sins, I mean, we can spark in one another, jealousy and greed and all of these things. And so we have to be careful. But as you unbox your smartphone, you also need to understand that this technology is glorious. And it should stir our hearts to worship God, who is behind all of this innovation. It's a tremendous gift. it is essentially a computer in your hand, you know? I did the calculations, and I looked at the Apollo 16 spacecraft, and it had a 70-pound computer on board that navigated it to the surface of the moon. Okay, this thing is 70 pounds. It's huge. There's a YouTube video where you can actually see this thing. It's so clunky. The smartphone has 10,000 times the computing power. So if you're using the GPS on your phone, your phone is using 10,000 times the power to get you from point A to point B as the Apollo 16 computer app. This is amazing. And it's not only does it compute, but you can take photos with it, you can take video with it, you can record audio with it. I mean, it's computing power, it's capturing power, and then it's what makes it truly revolutionary is now it's all perpetually connected to the web. And so there's a lot of consequences to that. You know, we're now going to view our lives as sort of a stage play where we can capture things, and that's going to change our habits. It's going to change the way that we view certain scenarios that we're into. We could talk about that. But the bottom line is we can now reach 200 to 300 people on Facebook immediately with our phones. That's average for a Facebook user. And so To a first-time smartphone unboxer, I would say see the power of the phone, embrace the potential of it, and stand in awe of just how wonderful this technology is and what you could do with it.
Mm, that's so good. And I love that you really strike this balanced approach that some people or parents or teens can be so tempted to view it just entirely negatively, without seeing the potential that it has to do so much good.
Yes, yes. That's one of the things I want to stress in the book. I've got this whole subsection where I'm just talking to artists and creators. And I want Christians to capture a vision for how they can use their presence in social media.
Right. Okay, so that segues right into the next question, which is specifically talking about social media and Christian teenagers. Should Christian teenagers use social media, and what advice would you give us on usage?
That is such an important question. You know, social media is ubiquitous. It's just everywhere, and it's pervasive. It's all around us. And so for me, social media, I'm going to put text messaging into social media as well. So I'm going to put Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, Twitter, and texting. I'm going to just put all of that together. So should you be on social media or not? I think that question really is a question of, will I thrive on social media or not? And that is tied into how am I personally wired relationally? So in my research, I think I read something like just over 50 books on technology and about 1,100 articles. You know, there's just a stream of constant information that comes out on these things. And one of the books that I read was really helpful for me is by Donna Freitas. She has a new book. It's called The Happiness Effect, How Social Media is Driving a Generation to Appear Happy at Any Cost, I think, something like that. Donna Freitas, The Happiness Effect. As a diagnostic tool to look into the social media habits of college students, it was incredibly helpful. So she talked to 200 or 300 college students and just kind of asked them, how do you use social media? Here's what she concluded. This comes early in the book. I want to read just the short paragraph. She writes this. She says, the more sensitive a person, the more emotionally vulnerable, the worse he or she fares on social media. The students I interviewed who suffer from insecurity, who have anxiety about their social standing, who fret about how they are seen by others, are the ones who are drowning on social media. These are the young men and women for whom social media is a highly destructive force, and they stand out from the many other students I met who feel ambivalent about social media and the rare few who really thrive in it. End quote. So we need to be honest about which of the three categories we fit into. Are we insecure? Are we people who are anxious about our social standing? Are we always fretting about how others view us? Those are the people that are going to be more susceptible to just being absorbed in social media in an unhealthy, addictive way. Then there's the ambivalent people. I mean, they're kind of on social media, but it's not a consuming thing. It's just naturally they're more balanced there. I don't know what that's like, but there are those who are ambivalent. And then there's some who simply thrive in social media. They're not addicted to the platforms. They use self-control. They're realistic about what social media can do, and they're They're balanced with their smartphone use. They are offline a lot. They have a healthy practice of getting offline and hanging out with friends. And but the fact is, and this may be helpful for Revolution listeners, what Donna also goes on in her book to show is that college students that are in pre-law or pre-med were more likely to not be on social media. And now the question is, why is that? And the answer she comes to, and it's pretty obvious, but the takeaway is that college students who were driven by a higher priority in their life, they're sort of aimed at an important vocational aspirations. It's big for them. That helps them prioritize and limit social media. So even if they were on social media, their driving priority in pre-law, pre-med, it helped keep it in check. And I think there's a lesson in there for all of us, actually. So I think a lot of times it's the rock in the bucket kind of thing. Like, you can fill a bucket with sand, and sand being, you know, social media, this feed that will fill your bucket every day. But you have these big priorities, these big, big rocks that you have to put in first. And so the challenge is, how do we fit the big priorities in, and then find time that we can use on social media. It's going to be a question of wiring, of how much popularity draws our heart. And so there's not a one-size-fits-all answer for this question. The answer is, how am I wired? Will I sink or swim in social media has a lot to do with how I'm wired. And so we have to know ourselves to really answer that question.
Yeah, that's so good. That's such a good answer. And it's interesting to me that you mentioned that the people who use social media most healthfully are the people who have a good balance between being connected and also being disconnected.
Yes.
And that disconnect is really intriguing and important to me as I think about the idea of the digital detox. And I know that's something that you have written about and studied. So my question is, do you think digital detoxes are a good idea? Which is kind of an obvious question. So then the related question is how should teens or anybody go about a digital detox?
Yeah, amen. I think digital detoxes are not only a good idea, I think they're essential for healthy living in the digital age. And so now we're talking about people who have a pretty immersive existence on social media, like me. I mean, it's part of my job. I just sort of live in the ecosystem of social media. And for me, that means twice a year for 2 weeks, I go offline. So no Facebook, no Twitter, no Instagram, no email, or very limited email based upon what kind of work I have to do. But then it's also wise for a digital Sabbath. That is, for me, 1 day a week where I'm off Twitter, off Facebook, off Instagram, off Snapchat, etc. I mean, for somebody who's on Snapchat, who is has snap streaks, and they've been keeping those up for months and maybe more than several months, it's going to be hard for them to step away. But it is really important, and it's something you need to think about. The bottom line is that we're tempted to live online constantly, without end. And there's a magazine cover. It's Time Magazine, back in 2014, had a cover image of a man's clenched fist and his forearm. And on his forearm, it was like an iPhone screen sort of like embedded into his forearm. And it was an article about the Apple Watch. It was really creepy. You can find it. It's titled, I think it's titled Never Offline. Time Magazine 2014, Never Offline. And essentially what they were saying is the Apple Watch is going to bring with it this sort of fact that we'll never be able to get offline. It will be perpetually plugged in. And so it's a creepy cover, but Never Offline is really, I think, a phrase that has come to embody, you know, our lives in a lot of respects. And so many things bring us now back to social media every day. Social media is like the place you go if you want to publicly complain about an airline and get a fast response, right? I mean, you can be in an airport, and so you go to social media. You go to social media for your news, because social media is now the gatekeeper of mass media. So if you need to know about something that's breaking news or the latest celebrity gossip, you know, you're going to find it through the social feeds. We're simply conditioned now to check social media in all of life, to sort of check into the drama of humanity, and is all getting rendered into categories that can be shareable in smartphones. Now, that means it's harder and harder and harder to go offline and digital detox. It becomes a matter of self control, self-restraint. It feels like your phone is being amputated from your life for those weeks. You know, it becomes harder and harder, which convinces me that it's more and more important that we do this. So I don't have a magical app that you can install on your phone to make sure that you're offline for 2 weeks. But it really comes down to personal discipline. For me, that means I delete apps off of my phone. I hide apps off of my desktop and on my computer. And there's a whole bunch of ideas. You alluded to the fact that I've written on this. I wrote an article called Know When to Walk Away, a 12-step digital detox. You can find it online. So there's a lot more details there. So digital detoxes are critical, but not simply to go offline, but to go offline to build more important habits of fellowship and reading and thinking and praying and communion with God. And so digital detox, it's not an end in and of itself, but it's a way to push back the social media noise in our lives so that we can focus on our communion with God and other priorities that can then have the space to thrive.
Right. That's so good. And that article that you wrote, that is a fantastic piece of work. I definitely very much benefited from it. And so, yeah, I would recommend. But it's so intriguing to me, I guess, since I was kind of late to the smartphone technology game with just getting my first smartphone at 18, but already I started seeing this pressure that you talk about to constantly be digitally connected, and even from friends, having everybody else on social media, and it seems like the whole world is all happening on social media or on technology. So I would ask you, how should we deal with this pressure to always be connected without taking a digital detox? Like, digital detox is fantastic, necessary, but what about when we come back?
Yeah, it's always thick pressure. We feel it all the time. And I think that what we need to do is acknowledge that my phone manufacturer, I have an iPhone, so Apple, my data provider, which is currently AT&T, the creator of my apps, there's a whole industry built to convince me that I should never be offline. And they are working overtime to make sure that the mobile experience that I have is more and more addictive. Now, the question is why? Well, it's obvious. It's because the more time that I spend online, the more valuable I become as a consumer to them. So the more time I spend online, the more I will spend on data. The more time I spend online, the more battery life I'm going to expect, the better screen resolution I'll need. The more time online, the more movies I'm going to watch and buy. The more time online, the more I'm going to buy online. And on it goes. So the more time I spend online, the more engaged in social media I am, the more, as you mentioned, this is interesting in your question, the more time I'm online, the more I obligate you to be online. And the more time you spend online, the more time you obligate me to be online. And so it's all built into this. And I don't want to preach some conspiracy theory, but you've got to see at some point that you are a consumer. You are worth money to huge corporations, to app creators, platforms. They are making revenue off of your page views to advertisers. So they want us to be never offline and addicted. We can't be naive about this. And so that, I think, is one of the priorities we need. Of course, the detox is so important. But I guess the thing that I would say here again is it's a heart issue. You know, for a lot of us, we don't want to disconnect because we have this fear of missing out. We have a fear of not being socially represented in the groups that we have. There's this lure of popularity. What drives us to be in social media is that we think if we go offline for 2 weeks that our existence is going to like evaporate. You know, we think of our social presence as being who we are. And it's just the way that our minds are being shaped by a lot of influences. So going offline it feels like something that's very dangerous, but it's something that's very health-giving to the soul. And so how do we deal with the pressures of constantly being online? We have to push back, go offline strategically, but we have to know that this is part of a huge complex, that the more time we spend on social media, the more we obligate others to be on social media, and that just feeds the whole thing. Seth Godin would talk about the hamster wheel, and he has some disparaging things to say about social media, but there's a sense in which We are consumers and we are worth a lot of money.
Right. And that also just all comes together to breed that FOMO, that fear of missing out, just becomes so pervasive. What do you think is the greatest danger for teenagers and technology?
In my book, I isolate 12 areas of concern that I have. The book is really me preaching at myself. So, you know, in all of the things I'm saying, I'm like preaching to myself. I'm not like preaching down like you must do this. This is me learning to do this balance as well. And I think the greatest danger for teenagers living in the digital age is that they will lose a sense of the true value of the local church. The world is now full of studies, warnings, cultural evaluations, and things that say that digital media is it's distracting Americans, and in some sense is damaging families. It's damaging the institutions of America. We're not becoming more relationally deep and authentic people. That's what a lot of these studies are saying. And this simple diagnostic is not new. It's not the minority voice either. You can track the New York Times. Some of the major news outlets have articles every week on kids spending too much time in front of screens, or the dangers of social media, or the power of cyberbullying, or the damaging effects of Facebook on marriage. On and on it goes. Our culture sees some troubling trends. The problem is our culture turns to institutions to help, and they really aren't there. And so the church is here to address a number of issues. I think there's two specific things that the church does really well. And that is, they're tied to even more specific concerns that I would have for smartphone users. The first concern is that smartphones tend to isolate us within a monolithic group. So the bond, the digital bond that we have with other people tends to be pretty uniform to who we are. We connect with people who are typically close to our age or have specific interests to us, or who are roughly in the same social or economic category as we are. That's not always the case, but I think that's true in a lot of cases, that our phones buffer us from diversity. This is a great point that was made to me in an interview that I did with him. He's an English theologian named Alistair Roberts. And Alistair is a pretty tech-savvy guy himself. I think he's in his mid-30s. He says, bear with me for a second, I'll unpack this, but he says, quote, "Generational differences are fundamentally constitutive differences for the human race." My translation, like, God intends to have all sorts of generations living together. New media is one of the many ways that our elders are rendered invisible. Not only our elders, but also the impoverished, the cognitively disabled, children, the less educated, the less literate, the less cosmopolitan, and non-Westerners. In effect, he says, our online communities render invisible the majority of the human race, end quote. Now that is a powerful insight. We hang around people like us. I mean, this is true of our phones. I mean, nothing is wrong with having friends like ourselves, but when those digital relationships sort of dominate and we sequester ourselves within this group of people that think like us, kind of look like us, are in the same age bracket, we separate ourselves from a majority of humanity. So when you step into a local church, you meet with people that hopefully are like-minded about the gospel and doctrine, but these people are very different from you, hopefully in age, social class, race, ability, disability. Those differences, those distinctions is how iron sharpens iron. And so in a church where we are so different from other people, it's the friction of those relationships, of being with people that are different than us, that causes the sharpening of who we are. That's God's design. And that's something that the online relationship isn't going to produce. It's as if, you know, if we are a knife and we need to be sharpened, the church is like a whetstone. It's rough. It's rough enough to sharpen you. And if you think of the smooth glass on the front of a smartphone, that's essentially like the trying to sharpen a knife on the front of your smartphone. Don't try that. Don't do that. But it's good to have those friends that are like us, but it's not going to sharpen you like the whetstone is. And that's what the church is. The second concern that's tied to this is that I think we're in danger of losing a sense of our embodied joy as Christians, what it means to be body, soul, mind, the whole being present. And there's a lot of dangers when it comes to teens and smartphones. But I think this embodied joy is one of the things that that Christians can speak into. There's three times when New Testament writers, apostles who have written letters to churches, they sign off with a line that says something like, I'm glad I could write to you what's on my heart, but I can't wait to be with you so that we can enjoy the fullness of joy together. The fullness of joy. And three times epistles close with that anticipation. So if we think of the letter as being a form of communications of social media back in the apostles' day, if we transport that into our own day and we think of the fact that on Sunday mornings we could stay at home and we could read our Bible apps, we could go online and read Christian articles, we could text other Christians, we could listen to sermons and even worship music in our earbuds, but there's something very distinct about being present in the embodied gathering of the local church where the fullness of joy can flourish in the diversity. And so it simply doesn't flourish through me writing you a letter about Christian things. That's the takeaway that I get from the epistles. So the local church, I think is for the next generation of digitally connected and social media savvy teens. I think potentially the value of what the local church is getting lost. So the world is looking for solutions about how the digital age is rewiring them, what it looks like to be healthy in social media, and the church stands here with arms open wide, doors open wide, saying, come here and experience what God intends for you as a whole person, not just as a brain that types words on a screen through thumbs, but as a mind and a heart and a soul, a whole person that needs to be reborn, a whole person that can fellowship and worship and experience this fullness of joy. So yeah, I'm losing a sense of the value of the local church is, I think, my greatest fear for the next generation of Christians in the digital age.
Okay, that's an incredibly insightful answer. And I have to say, that's not what I thought you were going to say, because I have read a lot of these articles that you mentioned, New York Times and various places, that talk about all these dangers for teenagers and technology. But I really have not read, now that I think, pretty much anything that focuses on the local church. So what steps can teens take to engage with technology in a better way, in a more healthy and balanced way?
So digital detox is, again, so important. Rooting into a local church, so important. And then I think the thing that stands out to me is that if you're a teen and you want to use your smartphone in a way that's wise, you have to learn to communicate well. So digital mission is huge for me. Again, because I think the smartphone is a product of God's intention for us and our generation. And I also think that if you have Christ and you have a phone, you have a mission and you have a message. It's all there. You have a digital mission. You don't have to become an apologist and give historical evidences for the resurrection. You don't have to be an apologist online. And please, please, please don't just use your platforms to spread memes that are like religious, cheesy memes like, you know, white Jesus with blonde hair. You know, share this if you love Jesus. Like, don't do that. So what should you do? I think first realize that digital media is so incredible because it opens up huge opportunities, a broad spectrum for content. So if you're a photographer, you can share your photos, you can share your paintings, you can share your sketches, your poems, your prose, your short stories, your testimony, podcasts like this, video podcasts, spoken word recordings, hip hop, music of all types, on and on it goes. I mean, there's an endless number of creative ways for you to express your message. And it's just simply staggering the opportunities that we now have. So we can communicate God's truth and his goodness and his beauty in so many different ways. It goes back to what C.S. Lewis told us about, you know, we're always influencing each other towards some direction. And so now I have a phone. It's more than just about self-expression. Christians don't just go on their phones to self-express. We know that what Lewis said is true. We're influencing other people. So how am I going to use my phone to influence other people? And so I think it just takes time to go. It takes time to think of, okay, what has God called me to do? And I think the key here is to becoming an edifying artist in social media, or whatever form it takes. It's driven by this deep, heartfelt engagement with God in fellowship with Him. And then growing out of that comes the message that He wants us to share. So it's not just about, you know, talking about scripture and doctrine and ethics, but it's about taking God's truth and His goodness and His beauty and letting that intersect with who we are and the story that He is writing for our lives. Then the stories that we tell online, they're not just about us. Our stories are about God and His goodness and how that is influencing us. That can be very powerful. If you have a smartphone, think about that. How can my time with God generate creative art that I can share online? So how do Christians balance social media? I think you ask yourself the question, where am I leading others? And let your heart online be driven by that place where your life meets the truth of God in personal communion. And I think that letting that drive your message will help you balance and be more authentic.
Excellent. Yeah, that's so something that we don't often think about when we're thinking about technology, but that's so good. Last question I have for you is about books, which is something I know that you don't like to talk about.
Oh, I'm such a book nerd. I'm such a book nerd, and you know it, and that was a nice way to say it.
Yeah, well, okay, so books. What is one book related to technology in particular that you think every teenager should consider reading?
All right, I'm going to give you some suggestions and then tell you not to read the suggestions, and then I'll give you some other ideas on reading. But the first thing that I want to say, and I want every listener to know this, that I have to start by encouraging everyone to read your book, This Changes Everything. I mean, I just recently read it and endorsed it, and it's not flattery to say that your book is really brilliant in helping teens establish gospel patterns and habits in their lives that they will need to flourish as Christ followers in the digital age. And I think especially the way you articulate your experience in the local church is gold. You make it so tangible, and you make it like this is really a young lady who's engaged in a local church. So I don't think you intended to write a book for the digital age in addressing technology, but you do it by what you explain there. So congratulations, it's a wonderful book on digital technology. I don't know of one book. So I've read like 50 books or so, and it's just if a reader wants to read on this topic, I would encourage a comparative study. And so I've got three books. I'll just mention them briefly. There's a book by Clive Thompson titled Smarter Than You Think, How Technology is Changing Our Minds for the Better, by Clive Thompson. Smarter Than You Think. This is broader than smartphones, but he says the digital web used wisely is boosting our brain power, our ability to read and think and process information. And it's drawing together communities of collaboration like never before. So, think of Wikipedia. So Clive Thompson, Smarter Than You Think, he's saying technology is making us really smart and we should embrace technology. Steven Johnson wrote a book called Everything Bad is Good for You and How Today's Popular Culture is Actually Making Us Smarter. And this is a really fascinating book because he takes detective shows and crime shows, and he looks at how complex the subplots have become over time. So he starts with Dragnet. Dragnet is an early detective show, and he found that in each episode, there's essentially one plot, no subplot. It's just a very clean, linear, tidy thing. It just wrapped up nicely in 22 minutes or whatever it was back in the day. Then came along the show Starsky and Hutch. Now they introduced two subplots within each episode. And so you'd switch back and forth between these two subplots. You'd switch like maybe four or five times throughout the episode. Then Hill Street Blues comes along, and they introduce nine subplots within each episode. So it's getting much more complicated. But each subplot takes center stage by itself. And then you come to The Sopranos. I'm not endorsing the show, but he does the research on The Sopranos. And what he shows is that you now have nine subplots, but very often within a mix of two or three overlapping subplots. So you're going along, you're seeing two subplots and three subplots and another two and another three back and forth. And so it's all becoming very, very complex. You have to pay attention to what's going on. And then those subplots bleed over into the next episode and the next episode and the next episode. So what he's saying is that TV shows, like, you know, for us, it's, my family loves watching The Flash. You know, The Flash has, like, you've got to keep track of all the multiverses. It's, like, it's so confusing. Well, 30 years ago, a viewer wouldn't be able to handle that. I mean, it's just, and so what Steven Johnson is saying is that technology, even mass technology, is making us smarter and more complex people, and it's for the good. Okay, now the third book is by Mark Bauerlein, Bauerlein. His book is simply titled The Dumbest Generation: How the Digital Age Stupefies Young Americans and Jeopardizes Our Future. And then it's got a subtitle, which is Don't Trust Anyone Under 30 Ever. This guy is, he is trashing anyone under 30. I won't even read excerpts because, I mean, he just ends the book on a blistering tirade of a rant about how dumb under 30-year-olds are in America. So those are three books on technology, two that are very optimistic, one that's way too pessimistic. But, like, doing the comparative study and jumping into the debate, I think is really, really helpful. So, having said all that, I think there's two things that every listener has to read. And the reason I say they have to is because these readings answer the two most important questions of the digital age. The first question is quite simply, what is the point of my life? What is the point of my life? Why am I here? And the second question is, what is the undistracted life? So what is the point of my life? What is the undistracted life? So question number one, what is the point of my life? Essential reading here is Matthew 22, verses 34 to 40. So I'm pointing people to the Bible, Matthew 22, 34 to 40. There, Jesus boils down for us the two commandments that cover the whole scope of Christian ethics. Yeah, a lawyer comes to him, tries to trip him up and say, you know, what's the most important commandment in the law? And Jesus says, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the greatest and first commandment. And then he says, the second is likewise, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. These two commandments, on them depend the whole law and the prophets. So the law and the prophets, you can summarize into two commands. It's all boiled down. We are created to believe in Christ, to embrace him, to rejoice in him. That's what it means to believe. It's to treasure Christ. That's what we're called to do. Faith is a treasuring. And then out of that abundant joy that we have in Christ, we turn our lives to face others and we pour our lives out in service and love to the tangible needs of the people that we see around us. And so those two priorities, that's the whole of the Christian life summed up. Embrace God, embrace Christ, and then serve others. If you let that really sink down into the groundwater of who you are, down into the root system of who you are, that is going to give you a lot of direction when it comes to how do I use my phone? How do I use social media? Am I overusing it? Am I abusing it? Etc. So that's the first question. What am I created to be? The second question is, what is the undistracted life? Okay, for this, it gets a little more complicated. I'm thinking of 1 Corinthians 7, verses 25 to 40, which is the longest and most detailed discussion of distractions in the Christian life. It's a text that I think a lot of listeners maybe at least are a little bit familiar with because it deals with the priorities of life and whether or not someone should get married or remain single. So this is where it gets complicated. It's not an easy text to wrestle with, but it is really, really valuable if you do. Sort of the subtext under 1 Corinthians 7 is this question about what does it mean to be distracted and what does it mean to be undistracted? Okay, so we're not talking about technology right now. We're not talking about social media. We're just talking about mission and marriage. And the text forces the question about domestic distractions. There's a laundry list of things that we have to take care of if we get married. the relationship calls for it. So marriage is a wonderful thing, and singleness is not a curse. You know, Jesus was single. Singleness is beautiful in its own right. But when it comes to mission and serving God, there are certain limitations that come with the domestic life of a spouse and kids. Paul's just very realistic about that. He's very straightforward about that. If you get married, your life comes with essential distractions. They are necessary. Kids, spouse have to be fed, clothes have to be cleaned, house has to be picked up. I mean, that's the nature of it. It's a way that you serve your spouse and you serve your kids. It's not worthless. It's not vain. It's just part of the deal. If you want to do frontline missions and give your life to being in a country that you could lose your life for sharing the gospel somewhere in the Middle East, having a family and having six kids is going to be problematic for that calling. You've got to wrestle with these questions. So what is the distractions that you're willing to take on? Which distractions has God called you to leave behind? Singleness and marriage are both beautiful things in and of themselves. That's what Paul is wrestling with. Now, it's complicated. Now, why I think this text is so valuable is because if you wrestle through what is distraction and what is undistraction, what is necessary distraction, what is unnecessary distraction, then you can layer on top of that now the digital distractions of social media and smartphone use, because Paul has now given you a paradigm to think of distractions. And what he's going to do in your mind if you study this text is you're going to realize that God has called us to a mission that we need to be as undistracted as possible to achieve. We're all on mission, and we all have essential distractions in our lives. That's part of what it means to live in this world and to live in a fallen world. There's just a lot of things that we have to do every day just to sustain our existence. But God calls us to think about what areas of life are necessary and what areas of life are unnecessary, all within the context of what has God called me to do. And I think if you wrestle with 1 Corinthians 7, you're going to have a better category for looking at the non-essential distractions of social media, and it'll help you to balance and to think through with more clarity on what types of things are healthy, what types of things are beneficial, and which types of things are optional and shouldn't be taken on. So Matthew 22, 1 Corinthians 7, those two texts for me coming out of the study are really critical for the digital age, because they're asking the questions that our culture is, but our culture can't find the answers, you know? And so Jesus tells us, here's what your life is all about. And Paul says, here's what distractions are like. And it's through that grid of those two texts that I think everything in the digital age becomes more clear. It doesn't answer all the questions, but it does help me understand like what is essential and what is non-essential.
Good. Yeah, that's very helpful. And I think a lot of young people especially are trying to think through what the scriptures have to say in regard to technology and social media. And to have those two passages, Matthew 22 and 1 Corinthians 7, that's excellent. Thank you. And that was a very robust answer to the question about books, and I loved it. That was great. Is there anything else that we have not touched on that you want to mention?
No, I would just say, I'd encourage you and your community, both your church community and Revolution, to continue to think through these things. This is an open conversation, and social media is going to change. Snapchat changed everything that we know about social media. You know, Facebook is kind of like a scrapbook where you could put all your photographs together for the world to see, and now Snapchat has totally changed all that. Photographs mean different things, and it's just a totally different type of relationship. And so technology is going to constantly be changing. And so it's not like I can just write the definitive book, put it out there, and then all of the discussion is over. Just go read the book. It's not like that. It's me jumping into a conversation that we need to have with our parents, with our pastors, with youth leaders, with our online community, and it's an ongoing thing. So what I hope to do by this conversation and the book is just to stir my own thoughts into that. But we need to keep thinking through what technology means for our lives, for the church, for our communities, for our families. That conversation isn't going to end, but I think it does need to start. And that's what I'm trying to do.
Absolutely. And if people are wondering more about your writing, you have a book coming out in April 30th, 12 Ways Your Phone is Changing You.
Yes.
That is a fantastic fantastic book that I think every teenager would greatly benefit from.
Well, thank you. Yeah, hopefully if they have time after reading your book, then they can read mine. Because I think our books come out in the same month. So
they do. They do. People can get them together.
Yeah. I've written probably a dozen articles now for Desiring God. You can go to my author page there, and there's a lot of articles on technology. Parents can find some things that are specifically geared towards parenting children in the digital age. But then a lot of I'm just talking to smartphone users, and a lot of interviews and articles that you can find there.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for talking to me, Tony, about these very important, relevant issues.
Well, thanks for having me. And thanks for the great questions. You really put some thought into them, and I appreciate that.
Oh, you're welcome.